Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's a branded world out there. Marketers and advertisers slapping their logos and dreams on products and experiences all over the place. 94% of Japanese women in their 20s now own a Louis Vuitton product. What makes that happen? Americans chase brands for status, for community, because those brands are whispered to us night and day. My guest this hour, On Point journalist Lucas Conley, says it's becoming a genuine disorder for business and consumers alike. Joining me now from Santa Fe, New Mexico, is Lucas Conley, contributing writer at Fast Company magazine and author of the new book, OBD, Obsessive Branding Disorder, The Illusion of Business and the Business of Illusion. Lucas Conley, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
It's great to have you. We've got questions for you. Let's just get a little sound in our ears. Right here at the top, Mad Men, the award-winning show on AMC, set in the so-called golden age of advertising, 1960. We want to learn from you how things have or have not changed. Here's the star ad executive Don Draper, played by John Hamm, waxing eloquent on his philosophy.
Advertising is based on one thing: happiness. And you know what happiness is? Happiness is the smell of a new car. It's freedom from fear. It's a billboard on the side of the road that screams with reassurance that whatever you're doing, it's okay.
Happiness from a billboard. Cadillac wants you to think of happiness as something more immediate, dismissing the usual bells and whistles in this recent ad, offering a simpler, sexier message.
In today's luxury game, the question isn't whether or not your car has available features like a 40-gig hard drive. It isn't about sunroofs or sapele wood accents, pop-up nav screens, or any of that. No, the real question is, when you turn your car on, does it return the favor?
Hubba Hubba from Cadillac. Lucas Conley, you have carved out a pretty towering challenge for yourself. We've been watching advertising and marketing for decades now. We hear it there in the Mad Men bit, a touch of the relic there, the old original kind of impulse. I mean, we know that they're out to seduce us. We've been told that for years, visibly, invisibly, every which way. What do you see going on out there that's new, Lucas?
Well, advertisers are getting much smarter. I think in reaction to the way the media has splintered in recent years and in reaction to innovations in technology and the way we can build products and how that is being democratized, what you're seeing is advertisers stepping in to fill in the void where there are products that simply aren't innovative enough. When you look at a brand that is approaching a market and it doesn't have an innovative feature to espouse, you'll often see them use emotional appeals to kind of shortcut our reason. And you'll see that works a lot faster than logical appeals.
But that's been going on for a long time. I mean, I don't doubt that you're right at some level, but I'm a little bit of a skeptic when it comes to the impact of this. I mean, we've been surrounded by billboards and ads and commercials for a long, long time. Yes, people have gone new places, and now they're whispered at in new ways. But are you saying that there's some cumulative volume of this or something newly insidious about the way it's getting in our ears that's fundamentally different?
Sure. Let me give you a couple examples. So when you look at the way a brand thinks about itself today, the brand now has to think about every single touch point. So when you think about a vehicle like a Cadillac, 20 years ago, 50 years ago, the blinker, that little tapping noise in the background, might have been ignored as just a utilitarian aspect of
the car.
You
mean I'm turning left or I'm turning right?
Right.
The turn signal, yeah.
Today, that sounds like the blinker and the straw in a fast food cup are now being considered as branding opportunities.
These mean a Cadillac turn signal should sound a certain way, or when I suck the last bit of, I don't know what, a Wendy's milkshake, it should sound a certain way?
Absolutely. When you're in a Wendy's, you want to know you're in a Wendy's by the sound of that straw, or at least Wendy's wants you to know you're in a Wendy's. Likewise with a Cadillac blinker.
If the sound of that blinker is appealing, or the milkshake in the straw is appealing, why isn't that part of the product? And why is that branding? Why isn't that product quality?
Because it's controlling the message. When it comes down to it, branding is about owning the message and controlling the message. And when you look at what brands are doing today, they have a hard time doing that with the internet, with Amazon, with the way we can communicate about products. We can share our opinions quickly, and we can share our opinions very, very broadly in a short amount of time. So when you look at what brands need to do, they need to find opportunities to grasp in the attention economy, our attention, little bits of our attention, whether it's the 18 hours a year we hear that blinker or the 89 billion times a year that straw plays in consumers' ears.
Now, why is that a problem? You call this obsessive branding disorder, and part of that disorder, as I read you, is in the consumer's mind, and part of it is you're saying we're substituting sort of branding gimmicks for product quality. But what takes it to the level of a disorder? I know it's a kind of just a cheeky phrase, but it is catching. What do you mean?
Well, because the trend line, the direction we're going is such that when you see advertisers innovate, they get better and better at kind of chipping away at our privacy, at chipping away at our identity, at chipping away at our emotional core. If you look at the technology that's coming out, whether it's in terms of brain scans and neuromarketing, in terms of understanding what appeals to us best, or you look at just the technology on the street, you know, when we heard the billboard that makes you feel better about your products or what you buy. Now the billboards can read our faces. There are actually billboards out there that can tell your age, your gender, your sex, and soon your ethnicity, and how long you looked at that billboard. So the understanding that brands and corporations have of our behaviors is getting richer, it's getting deeper, and it's getting to the point where they can shortcut our own critical thinking.
What do you mean when you say branding marketing efforts are chipping away at our personal identity? I'm not sure I follow that.
Sure. The object of any advertisement is to sell and to sell us on an idea, to sell us on an emotion, to sell us on something that will make us believe. And if it's, you know, the background noise of the blinker, it's simply to get inside our consciousness so that we think that's the Cadillac sound. That's what sounds right to me when I'm in my car.
Why does that diminish my identity? Maybe I like that sound. Or are you saying it's actually molding me, not just the sound of the turn signal, but my ear, my perception?
Well, because when we look at emotion, and which it works 3,000 times faster than logic, and the ways that brands are figuring out to get into emotion, and the new kind of rallying cry in advertising is loyalty beyond reason. This sense that when you look at a new car, you look at a new deodorant, why not buy a private label? Why not buy a cheaper brand? That argument's getting more and more difficult for brands. They need to find an emotional hook, an emotional appeal, and the best way to do that is to hook you on something that you either aspire to or believe about yourself or want. It has nothing to do with the quality of the product. It has nothing to do with any reasonable, rational appeal of the product. And I think that's happening, especially in terms of our economy right now, when brands have less and less appeal over their private label competitors.
But I thought you were saying that they have more appeal, that we're prisoners of brand, and that's part of the consumer obsessive disorder that you describe here. At the same time, those companies are up against all kinds of low-cost competitors, so we know they have to build that brand. But if 94% of Japanese women in their 20s have a Louis Vuitton bag, somebody's pretty good at that.
And they're getting very good. And I think that's the tension you're seeing in the market right now, is that people are expecting more of brands. They're getting less. Brands are promising more and their appeals are getting better, but their products aren't living up to these promises. And you see that in the surveys where the expectations continue to go up of brands and the satisfaction levels continue to go down.
So chipping away at consumer identity, you say, and chipping away at our emotional core with those repeated appeals and maybe some manipulation there. But you also have a critique embedded here of companies themselves and their products, saying that they're giving us emotional kind of hubba-hubba instead of the actual top-quality product.
Absolutely. And what's funny about this is when you look at the numbers, advertisers themselves don't even fall into this kind of belief system. They understand that branding is not as meaningful as they're trying to spin. And the consumers, you know, are kind of fighting with that tension, kind of trying to understand what of this is useful to me, what of this is actually a good product. And you can see this played out in every aisle of every Walmart and Target across the country.
No, I mean, are you saying that the products are deteriorating in quality and what's being substituted for the quality is merely an emotional attachment? Are consumers really that emotion-oriented? If the product falls apart in my hand, surely that's more powerful than kind of feeling of affection engendered by some TV campaign.
Right. I wouldn't say that the products are deteriorating quality. I would say that the products are continuing to get better in small increments, but that the quality gets broader. Now you can get the exact same cough syrup from 15 different companies. Now you can get the exact same you look at Hyundai as making luxury vehicles. When you look at this kind of the trend line we're looking at right now, more and more products, if you consider the iPhone even. I have an HTC phone, which is an unknown brand out of Asia that cropped up in the last 2 years. The parity, product parity between private label goods and what we consider brand name goods is getting closer and closer. And in order to kind of hedge their bet on their brand, brands are trying to up the emotional appeal and up that just that glamour, that that niche they have in the market, as opposed to actually making a better and more innovative product to separate themselves from the crowd.
But if they can't do that fast enough, maybe we should welcome this kind of brand marketing as the savior of the American economy while they try and stay ahead on product quality. I mean, would you do something different if your choice was losing market share or bumping up an emotional attachment to your brand? Wouldn't you do the same thing in their position, Lucas?
I think it's a tough call, because when you're in a commodity market and Walmart's telling you, hey, our private label goods are outselling you on the shelf, your options are make a better product or make a better package. And right now, what brands are choosing to do is make a better package.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the ocean of marketing we live in, the branding of everything practically, and our growing obsession with brands. My guest is Lucas Connolly. He joins us today from Santa Fe, New Mexico. He's a contributing writer to Fast Company magazine, author of the new book, OBD, Obsessive Branding Disorder, The Illusion of Business and the Business of Illusion. Of course, it is everywhere. Let's listen to just a few examples here. NBC is the biggest loser. You know, the contestants compete to see who can lose the most weight. Fitness trainer Bob Harper teaches them to exercise and eat better. But when it comes to food prep, not just any plastic bag will do. Listen.
I want to get you guys in this habit of doing is getting food prepared for yourself at home. What I like to do, I get these Ziploc freezer bags, and it's like a forced portion control.
Okay, it's got to be Ziploc. NBC's The Office. Pam's talking about Michael's love affair with his new jeans, blue jeans, as the camera zooms in on their Levi's label. The bit's paid for by Levi's.
Michael and his jeans. He gets in them, and I'm not exactly sure what happens, but I can tell you he loves the way he looks in those jeans. I know that's why he started Casual Fridays.
Okay, Levi's, and here it is in the series 30 Rock. Tina Fey, she's right out there with it. Doesn't hide the product she's promoting.
Are you all right?
Well, last night I... Never mind. These Verizon wireless phones are just so popular, I accidentally grabbed one belonging to an acquaintance.
Well, sure, because that Verizon wireless service is just unbeatable. I mean, if I saw a phone like that on TV, I would be like, where is my nearest retailer so I can get one? Can we have our money now?
Can we have our money now? Lucas, I mean, there are many examples that you describe in the book, but certainly in the popular culture, it's all over.
It is, and I love that last one because it's such a send-up of the whole market and the trend that's going on right now. And just a couple days ago, actually, the FCC came out and announced that they're going to take a closer look at the way product placements are appearing in network programming here in the U.S., which is finally following up with what's been going on in Europe for years now.
I'm still trying to get my head around, and I wish you'd spell it out for this, the disorder piece here and exactly the cost. I Americans are so accustomed to this that I'm not sure they necessarily see it as a problem. And, it's just kind of the world we live in. Billboards were everywhere. You know, Lady Bird Johnson took a bunch of them down. Now there's ads on the internet. Okay, there's product placement everywhere, but it seems to me there's a generation that sees this as just part of the natural order of things.
Well, one way to think about this is the term that a lot of advertisers and branders will use when they're approaching this kind of advertising and branding is making meaning. In other words, to kind of create something that either a tradition or a ritual or in some way important to people and kind of weave it into our lives. The most obvious example you can think of on these usually is like the Hallmark holidays, when you kind of create a holiday and eventually people kind of form a little bit of a tradition around it.
Mother's Day or Father's Day or whichever one you like.
Sure, and of course we can't make a holiday every day, but when you look at brands and how they approach this idea, that's the main philosophy. So let's take Kleenex, okay? Is if you've ever seen a commodity product, it's a tissue. You walk down the tissue aisle and you're facing 8 feet, 100 feet long of the same paper product.
Yeah.
Maybe the box is a little different. Maybe there's an aloe scent in there, mm-hmm. but really what we're talking about is, you know, a variety of different products that are exactly the same. Kleenex, as well as a variety of other paper products, have approached this branding, making meaning philosophy by doing some experiential marketing. And we'll see this in the Olympics because Kleenex has developed an entire documentary around this new campaign called Let It Out. And the Let It Out campaign encourages you to sit down on a blue couch in various cities around the country with this fellow who's an anchor for this campaign, who then sit and talk to you about something that makes you cry,
sort
and then you
of
use your
Oprah
Kleenex.
Style. Let it out.
Yeah, let it out. And when this campaign started, they've kind of honed it over time. There was originally some online elements that encourage people to talk about their maybe suicidal tendencies even.
Is it meant to come across as serious or as a send-up? I'm never sure these days.
Sure. This is they're positioning this for grief, for joy, for any kind of emotion that would generate tears. And they've got a snappy little song with a snappy little motto and a mission statement. The whole thing is a multi-million dollar campaign.
And then your Kleenex will be close at hand. But I mean, they're already the generic term for those tissues, haven't they? 1 year ago, what's the new distinction here?
I think the idea is that this is such a commodity product. None of us has a problem recognizing that the Let It Out campaign is pretty silly. But when you look at other brands that are doing this in a more convincing way. You look at a NASCAR, for instance, and NASCAR has everything from romance novels to branded meats. There's a lifestyle that develops around these brands. Look at the high-end brands like Louis Vuitton when people kind of incorporate these brands into multiple areas of their lives, and they begin to see things like cause branding, where a brand will stand behind a cause and you feel closer to this brand. These are the relationship between brands and our lives is kind of getting they're getting closer and they're co-opting both emotion and senses of a sense of value. When you purchase this product, it means that I support the environment. When I purchase this product, it means that I support this philosophy, whether it's something as like a sports philosophy like NASCAR, or it's an Apple computer philosophy, which you see kind of a cult philosophy around those
right.
products.
So an orb of meaning around these products and their branding that you describe as sort of taking the place of our own directly generated, maybe authentic is the word, meaning. And yet people have adopted these to such an extent that I don't know if people entirely see the difference anymore. Let's go to Tucson, no. Arizona, and take a call from Angela. Angela, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to say that I, despite all reason, stop at Starbucks every morning, and I'm teased incessantly by my husband about it because of my brand loyalty to Starbucks.
He thinks you're a prisoner of Starbucks, does he, Angela, there in Tucson?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am. Even having once overcome a caffeine addiction, I would continue to go there every day for a caffeine free coffee.
So are you the prisoner of a disorder then, to your mind, or is this just life and no problem?
I collected disorder, I imagine. You were talking about branding, and I think that one of the great things that Starbucks does with branding is that they branded their baristas. They have a particular type of person who's cheerful and intelligent and is happy to see me every day, no matter which Starbucks I go to.
So there's a whole experience beyond the coffee, and the country has paid for it. Of course, the news last week that, 600 Starbucks are closing, so there's a limit maybe to what people will pay. But Angela in Tucson, take care of that need. Lucas, what about Starbucks, the coffee, the experience, and the closing of hundreds of them? Does that mean there's a limit to how much it works?
It was interesting to see Starbucks step back recently, and you wonder if the kind of premium coffee thing is going to – it has hit its ceiling. And they're a great example of what marketers call brand churches, when you have a particular environment that you can control, that you've got smells in there, you've got sounds in there, you're controlling all of these elements that kind of generate the atmosphere of the brand. And brand tribes is another term marketers use for people who kind of circle around these brand churches, whether that's a NASCAR or it's a Starbucks. When you know, even if you've cut the caffeine, you're still going back for those other things that you're hooked on, that, you know, that environment, that third place, as they call Starbucks, away from home and work.
But is Starbucks' recent cutback, do you think, does it show the limits of marketing? I mean, there's only so many people who are going to pay whatever it is now, $3 for that latte, no matter how enticing they try to make the brand environment.
Yeah, and I think what we'll see with the economy right now is how Starbucks reacts to that will be interesting, because that it will have to be more of a branding initiative. They tried some breakfast sandwiches and that didn't really go over well. People weren't ready for that and they weren't interested. They tried retraining the baristas and that was more of a publicity stunt, I think, than anything. So they're kind of grasping. And then now, you know, in contrast, you see the rise of a Dunkin' Donuts, which is just expanding like mad. I think these two are a little more related to the way that people are spending their money right now. But the best way that Starbucks the Starbucks reaction right now will have to be, how can we kind of enhance the brand experience in such a way that people feel like they're coming back for that richer Starbucks feeling, because they can't offer us a more premium coffee. They've played that card.
They may just have to bring the price down a little, I wonder. Holly's calling from Dorchester, Massachusetts. Holly, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for such a great topic. I'm calling to see whether Lucas has seen WALL-E, the new Disney Pixar film.
I saw that with a bunch of nieces and nephews just in the last week, and the whole subject here today made me think of it as well, Holly. But why does it bring the movie to mind for you?
First of all, I didn't know what to expect when I went into the theater. I hadn't seen any previews or anything, and I was really struck by the fact that the movie, for anyone who hasn't seen it, is a real parody of branding, consumerism, overconsumption, etc. And, you know, the movie is being put out by Pixar, which I believe is owned or, you know, works with Disney in some way.
Right.
And I just thought, if Disney, which, you know, if you look up branding in the dictionary, I think you might see Disney in the definition.
Right.
And I feel like if they are secure enough in themselves and in their place in the world that they can actually make fun of the issue, I was amazed by that.
It's a great point. Lucas Conley, I don't know if you've seen it, but of course it's the little robot in the post-apocalyptic world, which we're led to understand has been destroyed by super consumption and marketing ourselves to death. Holly's got a great point. If Pixar and Disney, you know, super branders are that comfortable with the whole notion, maybe they've just won, Lucas. Maybe you're barking up a tree that's gone.
Well, you know, and Disney is—they're the leader in the field of getting brands out there, of branding, of controlling that message. And I think it's a sign of the times. I haven't seen the film, but I think it's a sign of the times if they're able to laugh at themselves and laugh a bit at the market, that consumers are laughing along with them. That we're all kind of aware that this has reached a bit of a point of satire where parody is necessary.
Laughing, but it's also apocalyptic and not really ultimately funny in WALL-E. Holly, thanks for your call. I want to bring another voice into our conversation. Joining us now from New York is Adam Hanft. He's founder and CEO of Hanft Unlimited, a marketing advertising firm. Clients include AT&T Wireless, Viacom, AOL, Time Warner, and Hertz. Writes a monthly column for Inc. magazine, and you may have heard him on American Public Media's Marketplace. Adam Hanft, thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, happy to be here, Tom.
So Lucas is looking out and seeing this kind of, you know, apocalyptic obsession disorder out there, where the authentic quality of our lives and the quality of products in many dimensions he sees being overwhelmed, undermined by marketing, by branding. Do you see it?
Well, not quite in the same way that Lucas sees it. I think that the WALL-E discussion was interesting because it really points out that, as was the Tina Fey soundbite, because it really points out that consumers are very media savvy, very sophisticated, and very aware of what's going on in the landscape. So it's not quite as easy to put something over on them and manipulate them as you might think.
Does the fact that consumers are very aware, though, mean that it's not working? Maybe they're aware and it's working. It's just the world as we know it. People accept it and live in it.
Well, I mean, I got a real real dichotomy out of Lucas's book, because when you go through it, he says, and rightly so, 9 out of 10 new product introductions don't work. So I really question the fact that, or the assumption that things are really working. I mean, if you look at the...
You mean that marketing is working.
That marketing is working, mm-hmm. that manipulation is working, that we're able to get inside the mind of consumers and control them. I mean, if you look at what's happening with Detroit, it's very instructive. By every measure, J.D. Powers and otherwise, the quality of American cars has gone up consistently over the last 5 or 10 years. But if you look at perceptual studies, Americans refuse to accept that. That's a marketing failure. One reason that American cars are not nearly selling as well as imported cars is that consumers simply do not believe that the quality has improved to the extent that it has. So there are many, many examples across the universe of marketing failures, of consumers being much more sophisticated and aware than we might otherwise give them credit for.
Lucas, what about it? If we're so wrapped around the axle of marketing, why do so many product launches fail, as you point out?
Well, and I think that when I look at Detroit, I feel like it's in part a marketing failure for not jumping up and reminding us that these products are getting better. But it's also an ingrained problem that, you know, resulted from years of producing inferior quality vehicles. I think it's going to take a lot more than marketing for people to kind of get around to the idea that the Chevy is at parity to the Toyota. But in terms of marketing failures, 75,000 new food and beverage products come out every year, and the average consumer only uses something like 200. I think 80% of our needs, 85% of our needs are filled by 180 products. So that need to get our attention, I think, is what's driving what I call a disorder. And I don't think that all the marketing is very good, but I think that the trend is the marketing's getting better. And that's when you start to see the trend towards neuromarketing, understanding how we think faster, and the trend towards emotional appeals that try and act faster than any kind of logical or rational appeal.
Adam, what about this notion that in its sophistication and in its volume, marketing is now becoming so pervasive that it sort of gets a wedge in there between us and reality? And pretty soon we're, drifting off there in holidays made up by marketers and desires made up by marketers and communities imagined and framed by marketers, and we just sort of drift away from reality itself. Is that over the top to you or not?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of an exaggeration. I think, first of all, that many of these branding strategies, which Lucas talks about, are far from new. I mean, Mother's Day was made up a long time ago. Halitosis, it was coined as a neologism by people who were in the mouthwash business. It was done by J. Walter Thompson, I think, in the 1920s. So what we're seeing now is really nothing new. And in fact, I would argue that the democratization that the Internet has provided and the power of word of mouth and recommendations, if anything, is the most powerful force to subvert the forces of marketing than we've ever seen. Every single study that's been done in the last 5 years says that consumers are more motivated and believe in what their friends tell them about products than what marketing tells them about products. And even if you discount the fact that people don't want to admit that they are motivated by marketing, the fact of the matter is that nothing has the ability to kill off a bad product faster than the Internet offers. And we're seeing that more and more. And I see a lot of marketers very, very concerned about the quality of their product, about innovation. And I don't at all buy the argument for a second that all we do in this business is sit around trying to think about ways to get inside the reptilian brain and to put this fancy marketing veneer on a lot of junk. True, there's a lot of junk out there, and true, a lot of innovations fail, but marketers are extraordinarily focused on improving the quality of their products and increasing what we call the Net Promoter Score, which is basically a recommendation measure.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the ocean of marketing we live in, the branding of everything, and our growing obsession, we're told, with brands. Lucas Conley is with us from Santa Fe, New Mexico, journalist out with a new book, OBD, Obsessive Branding Disorder, The Illusion of Business and the Business of Illusion. From New York, we're joined by Adam Hanft with Hanft Unlimited. He's in marketing and advertising and says, think again. Branding all over the place, marketing all over. Here's TV celebrity chef Rachel Ray. She's opened her kitchen to product endorsements. Listen here how she begins a segment of her show with her arms wrapped around a bag of cheese puffs and a huge smile on her face.
Before we get to what's for dinner tonight, I'm hugging my new best friend. It's like a teddy bear and a nutritious snack all in one. I've got a ring of cheese around my lips because I've been munching away on Snyder's of Hanover's multi-grain cheese puffs with 20 grams of whole grains per serving, and they are delicious snack of the day.
Woohoo! Rachel Ray with a new best friend and teddy bear right there, and it's, cheese puffs. How about this one? Here's an ad put out by the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and it's lauding CO2, carbon, the major ingredient in global climate change, as natural and good for the planet.
It's essential to life. We breathe it out. Plants breathe it in. It comes from animal life, the oceans, the earth, and the fuels we find in it. It's called carbon dioxide, CO2.
Love your carbon dioxide. And a little more from Mad Men. Here are the executives of the advertising firm and the AMC show. At the center of the show, they watch a spot. We're in a political season. Watching a spot here, it's set in 1960 for presidential candidate John F. Kennedy.
We'll measure him against the others, and when you compare, you'll
catch. Looks like a Maypole ad.
It's incredible.
Happy days are here again. I'm just wild about Harry. It's light. It's fun. Doesn't cloud the mind with, I don't know, issues. And it's catchy.
It's catchy like it gets in your head and makes you want to blow your brains out.
The president is a product. Don't forget that.
The president is a product. How could we forget it? But Lucas Conley, again, that's set in 1960. Adam Ham says, look, this stuff goes all the way back decades and decades to the early 20th century. This issue of what's new keeps coming back here. And what Adam describes is the sort of countervailing force of the internet and the way people can put their opinions up there to puncture branding, to puncture marketing campaigns. What do you say?
Sure. And to respond to what Adam said about word of mouth, I think that's a very good launching point for where brands are making new efforts today. If you look at the Word of Mouth Marketing Association, a new group that cropped up in the last decade, their estimate is now that 2/3 of purchases are influenced by word of mouth. And this is an area that brands are very interested in, that corporations are very interested in controlling the message.
But word of mouth is just people talking to one another. So
sure.
That's always happened.
So how do you formalize that? How do you make a marketing campaign that will help make people talk about what you want? Well, you sign them up. You sign them up with the opportunity to be part of a community, to get reward points, to be sent free products, and that's what brands are doing right now.
But
Procter
isn't that
and Gamble.
A teeny tiny percentage of the people out there talking about, you know, their products? I mean, it must be a minute number who are sort of incented directly by the company somehow.
Well, this is interesting because if you look at just one campaign, Procter and Gamble's Vocal Point, sure, which is 650,000 mothers, that's 7% of U.S. mothers with a kid under 19 in the house that are part of basically a community that markets everything from Procter and Gamble's products, but they also pimp these folks out to ABC, Toyota, other companies that want to spread their message. And these are messages that are tailored for them to pass on in their social networks to say, oh, this new foaming soap, you know, is really great. Why don't you go ahead and try it with your family? Your kids will love it.
Adam Hampt, 650,000 American mothers pimped out for Procter and Gamble. Is that the way you see it?
No, I really don't. I mean, I'm aware of P&G's initiative, but it's a little bit like all the fears that we had in the 1950s that the communists were coming in and brainwashing all of us. I just think, going back to the point I made earlier, that consumers are much more sophisticated and immune to manipulation. I mean, you played the Rachel Ray bit and other examples, but, you know, don't forget that was how television began in the 1950s. Texaco, mm-hmm, and the cigarette companies and everybody else owned those shows, and then we saw a reaction that went the other way. So there is sort of a Schumpeter long ways of destruction going on here, I think, creative destruction. And I think we are now in a point where marketers are looking desperately to stick their name and insert their brand, and ad creep is real. But I think it backfires more often than it succeeds. And I think it's easy to take a couple of examples and try to weave them together into a thesis. But in reality, that's not what's happening. I mean, Tom, have you ever been approached by somebody trying to pimp out somebody's brand?
No one has come to me in a bar and said, you've got to try this new light beer from so-and-so. No, on the other hand, you know, yes, I mean, soap and Texaco and everything else were there in early radio, for example, but, you know, we do live in the media age now. I mean, we're confronted by more kinds of media more often than ever, and it's not hard to imagine a kind of super reality being woven over everything by marketers who are also very sophisticated, as Lucas says, Adam.
I think that's true. There's, you know, people do talk about, you know, whether or not we are in one big Truman Show. But I think, you know, when you look at the millennial generation, they are very aware of, again, when they're being manipulated, when someone is co-opting them. And I don't see a lot of blind obedience to brands. I see a lot of postmodern kind of ironic mocking of brands as much as I see falling into place behind brands.
Of course, that irony gets played, too. I want to look at generations, but we've got so many listeners who want to come in. Let's go to Toledo, Ohio. And Chris in Toledo, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great show.
Thank you.
I really want to talk about what disturbs me is all these health-related commercials, particularly the infomercials. You see Kevin Trudeau promoting some supplement or some book about supplements, and, you know, I think it can be dangerous. Obviously, people may not they listen to him and they don't go to their doctor, and who knows if these supplements even work. And what about even the regular commercials with the regular brands, the blue pill, the purple pill, all these.
But is that stuff any different from the traveling medicine show that might have shown up in an American town 150 years ago, Chris?
I guess it's just taking it to the next level, and you'd like to think that people would listen to their doctor or somebody before they listen to some ad that who knows whether it's proven or true or whether it even works.
Yeah. Chris in Toledo, thanks for calling. Lucas Conley, how about it? When it comes to health in particular, we've been talking about the prescription drug industry here and how people get pulled into requesting, desiring, you know, feeling they rely on all kinds of things that may or may not be really good for them. But again, that dynamic has been around a long time.
Right, and I think the important thing that people are starting to ask for now is more clarity. I think that's evident in the FCC's approach to opening up the conversation about product placement recently, and it's evident in what we're seeing in other leading countries across Europe and especially in England. They just passed a law a couple weeks ago saying, you know, that there's going to be jail time of up to 2 years and fines if you do not reveal that you're associated with a product, if you're out there posting online or you're advertising or speaking on your program. If there's not a clear message to the consumer that you're associated or that you're being paid for this, then you know, there's going to be penalties.
Let's go to Mark in Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you?
Very well. What do you know?
I have a comment and a question. My comment is that it's bad enough when consumers no longer know where reality ends and marketing begins, but it's even worse when voters have that problem. And you may recall that Richard Nixon's first chief of staff, who was H.R. Haldeman, and he spent 20 years at the J. Walter Thompson Agency before he got into politics. Of course, that's the largest advertising agency in the country. And we spent weeks now with commenters talking about whether Obama or McCain have branded themselves or the others sufficiently.
Yeah.
And so my question is the fact that voters have a hard time telling reality from the candidates' brands, is that a natural outcome, unfortunate but accidental, of hiring ad people to help run campaigns, or is it more insidious? Is this an example of ad agencies and ad people trying to elect a government that will make it easier for them to sell snake oil?
Maybe a kind of spillover or commingling of marketing and politics, though again there, a lot of that's always been around. On the other hand, you can imagine somebody like Karl Rove would probably have had a great career in marketing. I'll go to both Lucas and Adam, but Lucas, first to you. What about Mark's observation?
Well, that's a good observation, and I think it is changing in the current market. If you look at there was a recent study done by CNN, and they basically studied the kind of neuromarketing appeal of the Clinton 3 a.m. phone call ad. Most of us will remember that ad as the call that comes in at 3 a.m.
It's 3 a.m., the president's phone is ringing, who do you want to answer it kind of thing. And what did they find?
Well, what they found, and they studied this in a smaller group, and then they verified this with a larger group, was that people – like you and I might say, that was, you know, that was just a political ad. I kind of resent Hillary for trying to scare me. Mm-hmm. And this is what most people said on the rational level. But when they studied the brain scan and the actual reaction towards the ad, they found that it was going straight, the kind of emotional appeal was going straight to the amygdala, which is this kind of irrational little nugget of the brain that wants to react in an emotional manner, and that people were being convinced that Obama was maybe a little too flimsy to be in the White House.
But Obama is the presumptive candidate, so maybe there's the limit. Maybe people make their own judgment in spite of the amygdala manipulation.
Sure, sure. But my argument would be this. Okay, marketers are figuring it out. They're understanding, okay, the amygdala and ways to kind of shortcut the irrational appeal to get in and kind of lock in on the emotional, the quick knee-jerk reaction is you know, in politics or selling potato chips is the way to go.
Adam Hampt, what do you see in our political environment these days in an era of, you know, big-time marketing? Do you see it informed by, infected by, leading the way ahead of the commercial marketers? What?
Well, that was the study that was just referenced was done, I think, by Drew Westman and those people. Drew is the guy who wrote the book, The Political Brain. There's no question that from an evolutionary point of view, we do respond to fear. That is how we are all here and don't have ancestors who were stomped on by dinosaurs. So I think the question really is this new? If you look at, you know, Machiavelli, the prince, he talked about fear as well. So intuitively, leaders have known for a long, long time what's required to manipulate. And branding, if you will, of political candidates goes back to the brand of Abe Lincoln, the rail splitter. It goes back to the marketing that was around, in fact, George Washington and those figures. So it wasn't as institutionalized, it wasn't as formalized, but the fact of the matter is we are all wired to understand the kind of leadership that's required, and the tools of the day, as they grow more sophisticated, are deployed against that marketing and that leadership need. But there's really nothing new about it. And I think what we're seeing in the current election is the question of whether or not branding by itself can do what people say it needs to do. And I don't see that happening. I think that the reason that Obama won was despite the fact that some of the more visceral, primal elements were, including the race side, were tapped into by Hillary. But despite that, he was able to win. And I think that shows really a triumph over manipulation.
The line is hard to make out here. Change is a pretty effective buzzword, it appears, this season as well. Let's take a call from Susan in Boston. Hi, Susan. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. I'm Susan Lynn. I'm the director of the Campaign for Commercial Free Childhood here
okay.
in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that that kind of concerns me is that you're talking about advertising and marketing to kids, advertising and marketing without really talking about sort of the ethical implications or what it means that we're raising a generation of children who are completely immersed in advertising and marketing.
And do you think it's different in quality or quantity in some significant way, Susan?
Both. But in 1983, companies were spending $100 million annually marketing to kids, mostly on television, and now they're spending almost $17 billion.
Does it make a different kind of adult when they grow up?
Well, I think that's a concern. Marketing's a factor in a lot of the health problems or public health problems facing children today.
So maybe they're eating too much junk food because that's done to them. Are you having any luck in pushing back, Susan?
Well, actually, we are. We've actually gotten McDonald's to change some of its branding strategies. Also, Disney. We're responsible for the fact that Disney's no longer marketing Baby Einstein as educational. But the point is that I think that there need to be voices out there, you know, sort of asking the question, what are we doing? Why are we doing this? Why are we doing this to kids? What does it mean that there's virtually no public space today that is completely public and not tarnished in some way by branding?
Susan Lynn, thanks for calling in. Lucas Conley, what about the generational facet of this? What did you find when you looked out there about how younger, let's say, Americans receive, perceive, interact with marketing?
Well, I think that the marketing towards children is something that people do get concerned about. There is kind of an immediate kind of visceral reaction to that. And I think that what you're looking at, what the FCC is doing with product placement right now, reexamining the issue, is mostly in reaction, I think, to the fear about marketing in children's programs, dropping commercials within the scripts of kids' programs.
But is it to your big thesis? Is it creating a generation that's somehow more vulnerable to marketing manipulation, less grounded in its own reality, or not? Are they more ironic and impervious?
I do think so, because I think when you have McDonald's working with Monopoly to replace a token and make a McDonald's fry token as opposed to a hat, for instance, you have a generation growing up with these little symbols, increasingly in our environment, whether it's a smell or it's a sound or it's a token. All around us. And when you have 18 years of that, you see people just basically accepting brands in their lives more, accepting the kind of messages they're hearing more. And it's kind of weaves itself into the tapestry of your life. And whether or not you want to measure that as something that's different from 5, 10, 15 years ago, you can kind of see the acceptance level of brands and that marketing in the millennial generation.
Well, you've put our antenna up, and there's a lot out there to hear, almost more than we can take on in an hour, but it's a fascinating take on the whole world of marketing. Adam Hanft at Hanft Unlimited joining us today from New York. It's been great to have you. Thanks for your perspective, Adam.
Happy to be here.
And Lucas Conley, author of OBD, Obsessive Branding Disorder, in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Lucas, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Ping Huang, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby, with help from Will Roselip and Samina Udine. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.